From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio, science and technology that is accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Katie Mullally. First this morning, we talk with Chief Seismologist at the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory, Jamie Farrell, about their recent study of the Yellowstone caldera. It's good news for all of us. Then we have a fascinating conversation with Keegan Mellstrom about what it is that has helped crocodiles and alligators survive for over 250 million years. Stay tuned for these guests. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Beneath Yellowstone lies a reservoir of magma filled with molten and superheated rock and exsolved gases. Scientists have long known that the chamber existed, but they hadn't been able to locate the upper boundaries of it. Along with the contents closest to the surface of that chamber had remained a mystery until now. Seismologists from the University of Utah and University of New Mexico have gathered specialized data of the ground beneath Yellowstone's caldera, providing them with crucial information about the potential threats of this massive volcanic system. Joining us to talk about these findings is Jamie Farrell, co-author of the study and a U of U Research Associate Professor of Geology and Geophysics and Chief Seismologist for the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory. Jamie, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me back.
So before we get started, remind our listeners about the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory.
The Yellowstone Volcano Observatory is a consortium of many different organizations. The University of Utah is one of them. We primarily run the seismic network in Yellowstone, and we are responsible for locating earthquakes and putting out information related to earthquakes in Yellowstone. But there are other organizations like the USGS, Yellowstone National Park, the different state geologic organizations, and then other universities as well that help contribute scientific wherewithal for the Yellowstone system.
Before we get into the findings, which are fascinating, let's talk about the caldera. I was reading that it's 55 miles wide by 35 miles wide and 10 miles deep. That's pretty big.
Yeah, it's one of the largest volcanic systems on the Earth.
Okay, so we don't need to be worried about it?
Nope, not really. You know, of the many studies that we have done on the Yellowstone volcanic system, one thing that we are quite comfortable saying is that the system does not look like it is anywhere near a volcanic eruption.
Okay, well, that feels somewhat encouraging to know that we shouldn't be too worried about the Yellowstone caldera. And yet, there's still that lore out there of the super volcano. Why, Jamie, is that a reality?
Well, I think part of it is just the name itself, super volcano. Mm-hmm. And you know, one of the things that we keep trying to tell people is really, there's really no such thing as a super volcano. There's only volcanoes that produce or have produced super volcanic eruptions. A super volcanic eruption is a defined term. It is a volcanic eruption that puts out more than 1,000 cubic kilometers of material. And Yellowstone has had many of those eruptions, but it's also had much smaller eruptions. So it produces, you know, not just the big, giant volcanic explosive eruptions, but it does produce smaller ones as well. So, you know, in fact, if it was going to erupt again in the future, the most likely would be a smaller volcanic eruption, like maybe a Mount St. Helens type eruption or even just a lava flow. But, you know, people hear the term supervolcano and they think of this end of the world, you know, catastrophe.
Yeah, exactly. Wondering what the difference is between a type of volcano that would come out of Yellowstone and these active volcanoes around the world, like Mount Etna and like the volcanoes on the Hawaiian Islands that are regularly active in some way, yet not, those also don't feel like you're in great danger because maybe they're, you know, letting off their steam and magma little bits at a time instead of one huge eruption. How do they compare?
Well, there's kind of different ways to compare these. So for example, Hawaii. Hawaii is, in one sense, it's similar to Yellowstone in that it's a hotspot, similar to Yellowstone, where you have this long-lived area of upwelling coming from deep within the mantle, coming out up to the surface. But the difference is that Hawaii is in the ocean, is oceanic crust, and Yellowstone is sitting on continental crust. And the different chemistry of those two crusts make the type of volcanism very different. Oceanic crust is primarily basalt. And as that melts, the resulting magma and lava is very fluid, and the gas can come out of it very easily as it's ascending to the surface. So when it erupts, it's not really explosive. It just produces these lava flows that can, you know, also be destructive, but are not as catastrophic as these big explosive eruptions, say like the Cascade volcanoes here in the U.S. or Yellowstone, because it's going to a very high silicic continental crust, and that tends to be much stickier, to use the unscientific term, but it's very hard for the gases to come out of that magma as it moves up through the crust. So it traps all the gas in there. And when it does erupt, it tends to be more explosive.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Jamie Farrell. He is a U of U Research Associate Professor of Geology and Geophysics, Chief Seismologist for the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory, and co-author on a paper that is doing some fantastic research on the Yellowstone magma chamber. So one of the focus, a big focus of this study was to determine the upper boundary of the magma chamber. So basically that's the top of the chamber. Why was that such an important part?
Well, I mean, one is that it's the easiest part to get to as far as studying. And you know, the way that we look at magma reservoirs, typically we do what we call passive seismology, where we put out instrumentation around the system and we wait for earthquakes to happen. And then we record those earthquakes with our seismometers. And that can take quite a long time because you have to record enough data to get, you know, a good image of the magma reservoir. So that can take years and years. So we didn't want to wait that long. So we decided, okay, we want to look at only at the very top of the reservoir. And, you know, so we brought in what's called the VibraSize truck. And this is a truck that's used quite often in the exploration industry, for example, the oil industry, to look for oil. And what it does is you drive this truck in, and we put out 650 seismometers all throughout Yellowstone. And we brought this truck in, and this truck has an apparatus attached to it that can drop a plate onto the ground and then, using hydraulics, can shake the ground. So in essence, we are creating our own really small, tiny earthquakes. And we can do this as many times as we want. And we can record the associated seismic energy with our seismometers. And since we can only produce very small shaking, it limits our ability to see really deep. But we can see towards the top of the reservoir. So we wanted to focus on the top of the reservoir. And so this was a very good technique for us to use. And, you know, if Yellowstone was about to, you know, become active and was ready for a volcanic eruption, you expect that magma would cool at the very top of the reservoir before it can make it up to the surface. So that's very a very important part of the reservoir to really understand.
I was reading in the paper that you were, I don't know if this is a recent finding, but the layer of strata above the magma chamber is very different than the magma chamber itself. Was that a new finding?
So what we found is that, you know, there's kind of two main findings of our study. One is that the amount of magma on the top of the reservoir, towards the top of the reservoir, but also that there's this layer of exsolved gases sitting on top of this thing. And what that tells us is that the Yellowstone magma reservoir is effectively degassing itself, which is good. And that gas is coming out of solution and making it up towards the top of the reservoir, then eventually making it out to the surface where we can record it and at the various hydrothermal systems on the surface. So, you know, that tells us that not only did we find out that the Yellowstone magma system is nowhere near impending eruption because there's not enough molten material down there, but it's also degassing itself. So that gas is not being trapped in that magma reservoir, causing pressures to rise to cause these explosive eruptions.
So I'm wondering then, Jamie, so the link and the connection between the thermal activity in Yellowstone and the volcanic activity in Yellowstone, is the thermal activity in the geysers, is that some way for the gases to escape? Is that the connection?
Well, the gases come out of the magma and travel through the rocks and then gets picked up by the hydrothermal fluids and then comes out to the surface. These are the pathways to the surface. So yeah, sometimes it comes out at a point source like that, like in a hydrothermal basin, but there's other places where it comes out all over the place, just out of the ground. So it doesn't only come out right at, but that's the major contributors are the big hydrothermal basins in Yellowstone. But that's one kind of, you bring up a good point in that, you know, we're focusing on the magma reservoir, but kind of the next step that we envision is that looking even shallower, looking at the connection between the magma reservoir and the magmatic system and the overriding hydrothermal system to see how those two are interacting with each other. And that would kind of go a long way in understanding how these systems are connected and how they influence each other and how effective it is at removing these fluids and these gases coming off of the reservoir.
Yeah. And so looking at, you know, looking historically, have there ever been any other indications from thermal activity? And I guess I can't think of anywhere else in the world where there is thermal activity like there is in Yellowstone, but has there been a connection made and or any indication that has ever been seen between the thermal activity and a volcanic eruption? So like some change in the frequency of a geyser eruption or something like that?
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of times, you know, obviously we've never had a historical really big supervolcanic eruption like Yellowstone that we've recorded. But we have, quite often we have smaller volcanic eruptions that are well recorded by instrumentation. And you know, we quite often see changes in the amount of gases coming out of the surface prior to an eruption. And this is because, you know, as magma moves up in the crust, you get less and less pressure holding those gases in. And as you reduce that pressure, more of that gas comes out of the magma. It's kind of like, you know, when you open a can of soda, when you open that, you know, the can, you release the pressure. And that's why all that CO2 comes out of solution. And you can get, you know, the explosions of soda if you shake it up. That's the same thing that happens with magma as it moves up through the surface up to shallower depths. And you can see those changes in the gases coming out prior to eruptions. And that's why that's one of the things that we monitor for in Yellowstone, to see if there are big changes in the gas content coming out.
Jamie, let's talk about the data gathering methods that you used. You had 110 locations where you put sensors and basically a really big truck that just pounds on the earth. What locations were these sensors and why did you choose those places?
So we actually had 650 sensors, 650 seismometers, and they were located all throughout all of Yellowstone. We basically put them along every roadway we could throughout the park. And these are temporary seismometers. They're small, and they run for about a month, and they collect data for about a month. But we concentrated many of them along two roadways that go across the caldera. And they were very dense in there, and because we wanted to get high resolution images, and the closer you put your sensors, the higher resolution images you can make of the reservoir. And we focused on those two transects, and we brought the VibraSize truck in, and we did that at 110 different locations, the VibraSize truck. And we basically used every pullout along the road that we could. And we would park at a pullout with the truck, and we would take the ground about 40 times at each site, over and over and over. And each one takes about 20 seconds. And we would do it for 40 times each time. And then we would record the associated the seismic energy as it propagates from the truck over to our sensors. And we did this in the middle of the night, and we had to do it at night, one, so we wouldn't be fighting, you know, the famous Yellowstone traffic all day. And also we would be able to actually park at the pullouts because they would be full if it was during the day. And then also it's less noisy. There's less road traffic during the night. So we wouldn't be recording all the traffic from the cars at night. So we did this all at night for about a week and a half and recorded all the data.
Jamie, I know I've asked you this question on the previous two interviews we've had. I'll continue asking this question regardless of how many times we interview you. P waves and S waves. Explain to us what they are and how it was that they helped you determine the composition of the chamber, because I still don't get it.
So they're just different types of seismic waves that are produced when an earthquake happens. And the first signal you typically record is the P wave, or the primary wave. And this is a seismic wave that kind of shakes in the direction of travel. So when it comes up from beneath, it's coming up almost vertical and hitting the seismometer. So it's primarily shaking up and down on the surface. The S wave, or the shear wave, it travels much slower than the P wave. So it arrives later, and it shakes perpendicular to the direction of travel. So when it comes up vertically, it's shaking side to side on the surface. That's one difference between the two, is the amount of the type of shaking that you record on the surface. The other thing is that liquids like water or magma, they don't have shear strength. So S waves cannot propagate through a pure liquid. They just won't make it through there. If you have a mixture of liquid and solids, they can kind of make it through there, but they're kind of really slow and they get all messed up as they travel through there. So the shear waves are a really good, since they don't travel through liquids very well, it's a very good way to see how much liquid is down there by how much of the shear wave is missing. Or if you don't see it at all, then there's probably a lot of liquid down there. So we use both of those types to not only see when they travel through the material, but also when they reflect off the top of that big velocity change at the top of that magma reservoir, we can map where that reflection is. And that's how we get how deep the top of the magma reservoir is, by mapping that reflection off of the top. And that's at about 3.8 kilometers beneath the surface.
Wow. Okay. Also, if you're talking about the size and the volume of the caldera, it's about 10 miles deep. Is that right?
It depends on where you're at. But like, you know, we say the top of the reservoir is at, say, 3.8 kilometers depth, which is about 2.4 miles beneath the surface. As best as we can see, we lose resolution as we get really deep, or we can't really tell if the bottom of the reservoir is very sharp or blurry, just because it's harder to see the bottom than it is the top. But the bottom of the reservoir is at about, say, 15 kilometers depth. So that's about 10 to 12 kilometers thick that the reservoir is.
Okay. And from where does the magma come in the center of our globe? And how does that caldera get filled? Is it seeping in differently, you know, in different porous materials, or does it come from one big opening?
Well, like I said, Yellowstone is what's called a hotspot. And it's this concentrated area of heat and material coming up from deep in the Earth's mantle, maybe from all the way down to the core mantle boundary towards the very middle center of the Earth. And this energy and heat is being, you know, pushed up through convection all through underneath this spot in beneath Yellowstone. And then as it moves up, the North American plate, you know, the crust and the upper mantle is moving over this hot spot, and the North American plate is moving to the southwest. And as it moves over this fixed hot spot, the Yellowstone volcanic system kind of migrates to the northeast, right? And you know, we can see all these old Yellowstone explosive centers moving down to the southwest through the Snake River Plain, all the way down to kind of the border area between Nevada, Idaho, Oregon, this, you know, up in that area. And that's at about 17 million years ago is where, you know, that area was active. And then as it moves to the northeast along the Snake River Plain, you get progressively younger and younger and younger explosive events till we get to current Yellowstone right now. And what happens is, as that heat comes up through the mantle, it makes its way up and melts continental crust. And as it melts, it produces magma. And as magma is produced, it becomes more buoyant than the surrounding cold rock, and it wants to move up into the crust and make its way to the surface. And as it gets to a point where it becomes, you know, neutrally buoyant, where it can't go up anymore, it pools into these reservoirs. And we get these areas of long-lived volcanic centers where you have these magma reservoirs like you have underneath Yellowstone. It's the same process that you see in Hawaii and in the Cascades, just on a much larger scale.
Jamie, last time we talked with you, we were talking a bit about this hotspot over Yellowstone, and you mentioned that as the crust moves, the crust is becoming more granitic, so less meltable, I guess. How is that composition of the continental crust changing, and how is that going to affect the Yellowstone area?
Well, what is changing is for a long time, the Yellowstone hotspot has been kind of burning through very thin continental crust, or relatively thinner continental crust, like we have here in Utah in the Basin and Range and all this stuff. But what it's running into now as it moves to the northeast into, you know, more towards the center of the continent, it's starting to run into much thicker, colder continental crust, much older and thicker and colder continental crust, which we call cratonic crust. So typically when you have these big continents, the centers of them are very old and very cold and very thick, and we call those cratons. So Yellowstone is now just starting to run into this part of the North American plate. So it's going to have a much harder time kind of burning through that colder, thicker crust. And, you know, we don't know exactly how that's going to affect future eruptions of Yellowstone, but we know it'll be different than the stuff that it's been burning through for the last while.
Okay. Well, this is great news to hear, because I know that when I was in emergency management, we did have plans for the Yellowstone volcano eruption. Well, Jamie, one more question before we let you go. On a different topic, I was reading this morning that there was a 6.2 earthquake in Turkey. What can you tell us about that? What do you guys know about that so far?
I haven't really looked too much into it. You know, the only thing I can pretty much say is that, you know, that's not expected. Turkey is a very seismically active area. It's a very seismically active area of the earth. And unfortunately, they've had a lot of devastating, very large earthquakes in that region. And it's something that people are looking at a lot, of these big earthquakes that have happened in that region. But I don't really know too much about it. It's just the fact that I know that it occurred, and for sure we record those earthquakes on our network. But other than that, we don't really do too much with those events.
Well, Jamie, this is a great study. We all like hearing that there's not a massive active volcano, super volcano, you know, a few hundred miles to the north of us. So thank you for that. Our guest today has been Jamie Farrell. He is a co-author of this study of the Yellowstone Magma Chamber, and he is also a U of U Research Associate Professor of Geology and Geophysics, and he is also the Chief Seismologist for the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory. Jamie, thank you for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
What can modern day crocodiles, alligators, and gharials tell scientists about how to survive mass extinctions? Well, quite a bit. When researching what it takes to survive, scientists have typically overlooked these crocodilomorphs until now. Researchers from the University of Utah, the Natural History Museum of Utah, and the University of Central Oklahoma have looked to crocodilians to try and understand why members of this unique group have survived through two mass extinctions. Joining us to talk about these findings and how they can help other species survive this current mass extinction event is Keegan Mellstrom, lead author and assistant professor at the University of Central Oklahoma. Keegan, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me.
All right, what is a crocodilian, crocodilomorph? There's a number of ways to say that word. What are they?
Yeah, well, for simplicity's sake, I will be using the word croc, because we have modern day crocodiles, which live partly in areas like Florida, but also, you know, like the Nile crocodile and the saltwater crocodile in Africa and Australia, respectively. And they are part of our larger group called crocodilians, which include crocodiles, but also alligators and gharials. And they are a part of a larger group themselves called crocodiliforms, which includes lots of extinct relatives. And that is a part of a larger group called crocodilomorphs, which get their start almost at the exact same time as dinosaurs, but do not include dinosaurs. So I had this entire study was over crocodilomorphs, but again, for simplicity's sake, It'll just be crocs.
Well, you were saying, and I was reading in the report that crocs, we'll just go with that, yes, have been around for 230 million years, but this is really one of the first times that this overlooked group has been studied. Why have they been so ignored?
Probably this 2 points I put on this. One, they're a victim of their own success. So they are oftentimes viewed as living fossils, because if you took an alligator or a croc today, even to an expert, many of them from 100 million years ago look almost identical. You know, if we could go back 100 million, 200, maybe 180 million years ago, you would be able to recognize a croc if it were in a dark alley. And so for that reason, there's kind of this perception that they're unchanged. They're not, but the perception is there. And the other thing is, they've just never had this huge diversity like other big groups are. Birds, mammals, lizards, snakes, they just never quite get to these big numbers. Even today, there are only about 26 species, give or take on how you break that up. And even at that high point, we're never getting into the multiple dozens of, you know, like hundreds of species at any one time. And so that makes it a little tricky to do these broad, you know, statistically significant studies. And so those would be my reasons why I think they haven't been studied before.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Keegan Mellstrom. He's an assistant professor of paleontology at the University of Central Oklahoma, and he has done a published study about crocodilian survival and how the crocodilomorphs have survived two mass extinctions. So, Keegan, am I to assume that those two mass extinctions have been the two most recent extinctions? And we think of those as the most recent one, or the fifth one, is the one where the asteroid or meteor comes out of the sky, destroys, kills all the dinosaurs, mass extinction. And the previous one, which was the fourth extinction, was that due to volcanic activity?
Yes. So this is the one, the fourth, the end Triassic mass extinction is the one that we have just most recently figured out what's the cause, or our hypothesis is, or hypothesized the cause, which is actually the opening up of the North Atlantic. And so basically Europe, Africa, South America, and North America started to pull apart from one another, and that triggered this big mass extinction that helped give rise. Dinosaurs were around, crocs were around, but lots of other groups were living alongside them, and that mass extinction basically helped clear the board for modern-day groups to dominate. It's a really important one that I love to talk about, and my co-author, Dr. Randy Ermus at the University of Utah, is a particular expert in.
Yes. Well, we love that you've worked with Randy Ermus, because we've interviewed him several times on this show. He's so interesting, part of University of Utah, as well as the Natural History Museum of Utah. So, okay, you love to talk about the fifth extinction, but I need to ask you about the extinction that scientists believe we are currently in, the sixth extinction. Why is there belief that we are currently in an extinction? Does it pertain to the number of species that are becoming extinct at a certain rate?
Yes, that's basically it, is the rate of extinction of mammals, lizards, birds is higher than the background extinction rate. So there are more animals going extinct at a faster rate now than there have been at normal times. And it's pretty depressing if that rate continues and we kind of amplify that over geological time. We are definitely in the beginnings of a mass extinction. And, you know, I'm not an expert in the math and the calculations of it, but I've read in some areas that we could be approaching the rate of the most devastating mass extinction of all time, the end Permian mass extinction. But it's not all doom and gloom. I say this to my biology students: although we've lost many species, we have not lost the vast majority. And so we absolutely have it within our power to kind of prevent any mass extinction. So I don't want to be super doom and gloom.
Well, Well, Keegan, let's get back to the crocs because it was such an interesting study. It was not all species of croc that survived, just a few. Tell us about the few species that survived as compared to the other ones. What was the main thing that you found that kept them alive?
We are hypothesizing that what they eat helped them survive. And this is this really fascinating pattern that we see in, we think we see in mammals as well. Sorry, I'm being the classic scientist and kind of couching my language. But crocs today, and we think in the past, judging by our work, have a really flexible diet. So they can eat almost anything. And that is a pretty unique trait. We take that for granted because as humans, we can eat almost anything, but there are just not that many things out there that can do that. And so this ability to eat insects as a baby and then amphibians as a little subadult and then some fish, and then when you get to be like 5 feet long, which isn't that big for a croc, to you know, grab a random mammal that's walking by or eat some mollusks that are hanging around by you, that is an extremely useful trait in a mass extinction where like 70, 80% of things are dead around you and, you know, the environment is devastated. So what we're hypothesizing in this ability to be a dietary generalist, it just means you can eat anything, really served crocs well through not just the end Cretaceous mass extinction, but also probably the end Triassic mass extinction.
But not all crocs were eating this way, were they?
Right. Correct.
So, how many species of croc died off as compared to what's left?
Oh, a lot. So in around the end Cretaceous, we had herbivores and what we call terrestrial hypercarnivores. So they're living on land and, you know, they look kind of similar to like a hairless wolf. So they're big, big animals, and they tend to go extinct. You know, herbivores never appear again. Omnivores never appear again. There were a couple that were in the late Cretaceous, but they're gone. Or the terrestrial omnivores, I should say. So they don't make it. And who makes it through is the animals that are similar to the ones that we see today, these semi-aquatic generalists, these animals that can live in both land and water and eat insects and, you know, the big mammal that's walking around and the dinosaur that is, you know, not dead. They don't need to, they didn't specialize on these big dinosaurs, so they don't need them.
So Keegan, it makes me wonder then about when you were talking about reptiles specifically being, you know, better omnivores than their terrestrial counterparts, that this should be a message to us, to we humans out there. You know, there is that thing you should eat always, you know, a variety of things. And the moment that you start narrowing in your focus of what you eat, that's when you start having food sensitivities to other things. So I just wanted to get your take on that.
Well, it's always important not to draw too many conclusions based on, you know, a paleontological study. And not only that, I mean, the boring answer is the physiology of a croc is very different than a human. But I think philosophically, a balanced approach to all things in life is critical. That's what my father always said to me, you know, Keegan, you know, balance is key. So I think if you take the scientist away, that is a good approach.
Well, we always are reassured when we hear a scientist who can also go into philosophy. So this is good. you know, when we see crocodiles or alligators, wait, and I wanted to ask, I don't know what a gharial is.
Oh, they're amazing. A gharial. Yeah. So they're really, really big. They're pretty exclusive now to the foothills of the Himalayas in modern India. But their past range was way bigger than that. But they have an extremely long, thin snout, and they specialize in eating fish. And there's some really cool work that is like looking at their eyes, because their eyes are basically on the top of their head. And they have this really bulbousy nose that's like a special organ. The gharials are very cool, but critically endangered, unfortunately.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So following up on this, when we see any of these alligators, gharials, crocodiles, we say, oh, they look so prehistoric, or they look so reptilian. And when we refer to that reptilian part of our brain that refers to the most primitive reactions and things like that, it's like we already know this about crocodiles. And going back to what you said in the beginning about why we haven't researched, I mean, we just take it for granted that they look so reptilian, they look so old, they look so prehistoric.
Yeah, it's really a shame because crocs' closest living relatives are birds. And I don't know if Randy, my co-author, has talked about this, but they're all part of this group called archosaurs. And birds have this really dynamic behavior. And the more we study crocs, alligators, gharials, the more we start to see kind of the echoes of this. And so there is really, it's not my work, but it's modern day biologists' work that's showing that maybe crocs are doing some sort of tool use. So they basically will selectively put sticks on their back and float around acting like logs only during mating season for these big birds. So they know the birds are gonna use these sticks to make nests. And, you know, it's like actually a pretty complicated logical train that they're doing, despite the fact that they're, you know, reptilian quote unquote brains. You know, their communication is really fascinating. They're really good parents. So like alligator croc moms are very defensive over nests, which is very different from other reptiles, but it's very similar to birds. And so this really, you know, the fact that they look so prehistoric, they all look pretty similar to the, you know, most people, has really kind of hampered the research on these really fascinating behaviors that's now starting to get done. And it's revealing really cool stuff, like I just said.
Kagan, I'm guessing that you didn't get the chance or wouldn't want to go and actually examine the contents of a live alligator or crocodile. And you can't examine the contents of the stomach of a prehistoric crocodilian. How did you come up with this data and your finding?
Yeah, it was not easy. So we use multiple lines of evidence in order to try to reconstruct diet. So stomach contents in fossils are very rare, and they're exceptionally rare in crocs because basically their stomach acid is so acidic that things dissolve in like a day. So unless you died, you ate something, died, and got fossilized perfectly, we ain't gonna get it. So there's like two that exist, which means we had to turn to teeth. So teeth of animals is related to what they're eating. Simple teeth correlate with carnivores. So like a dog has simple teeth, a crocodile today has simple teeth, and herbivores have complicated teeth. But many crocs don't preserve their teeth, or their teeth are basically hidden because their jaws are closed when we find the skulls, and we don't want to take them apart because that's risking the fossil. So we had to use skull shape. And to do that, we had to do a study on modern day mammals, reptiles, and crocs. So lizards and crocs. And we found that, yes, who you're related to plays a key role in what your skull looks like, but also diet. So basically, skull shape is related to, yep, relatives, close relatives, but also what you're eating. And so using multiple lines of evidence, the very rare stomach contents, the shape of an animal's teeth, and its the shape of its skull, we're able to hypothesize these diets. And always a good gut check was the vast majority of them ended up being pretty similar to modern day crocs, both in teeth shape and skull shape. And so we're like, great, we're on the right path here.
I was reading that you traveled across seven countries and four continents for your research.
Yeah.
That's quite the adventure. Why did you have to be spread out so far to get your data?
Because crocs have been so successful. They're all over the place. They are, you know, today they're on lots of different continents, you know, except Antarctica and in Europe. And their range was even bigger in the past, especially when the climate was warmer. And so we have to go to these different institutions to capture as much data as we can. So yeah, that was a blast, but also very scary. I was traveling alone for most of that, which, you know, you're in lots of different countries, you don't speak the language, trying to get to navigate to these museums. Some people are excel in those situations, but
you're not one of them.
I'm not one of them.
Well, bravo for making it happen. So you and Randy Ermus examined the teeth and skulls of 99 croc species and then 20 living croc species, mm-hmm. To reconstruct these dietary ecologies. That's incredible. So you just went to different museums. Is that how you found them all?
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, the published literature shows or it says where these crocs are held. And so, you know, we know, oh, there's this insanely good fossil record in modern day Argentina. So we're gonna go to these few institutions in Argentina. And so you go into these museums thinking that there's gonna be some specimens there. And oftentimes there would be, but then sometimes you'd be surprised by, you know, something that I just overlooked, and oh my gosh, you know, there's this beautiful skull, or sometimes, the fossils wouldn't be as good as you thought they'd be. So especially early illustrations before, you know, pictures and digital cameras became super common, they would have these beautiful illustrators or these beautiful illustrations made by these professional illustrators of these fossils. And so you think it's gonna be one thing and you get there and it turns out that actually it's pretty scrappy and somebody did some really good work bringing multiple skulls together to get that perfect morphology, but that perfect shape. But it turns out that, you know, I need a complete skull for this study and somebody has based this reconstruction off of 12 partial skulls. So that also happens.
Uh-huh. Oh, interesting. I'm wondering, in this extinction, climate change is warming up the ocean and warming temperatures in general. What is that meaning for crocs that are living now? Like, I remember hearing at some point that there was this concern. So we find crocodiles in Florida right now that mm-hmm. they're going to be migrating northward because the temperatures are, is that a real thing?
Potentially. Croc diversity does go up in warmer temperatures. So this is one of these things that, in my study, I wanted to kind of, you know, tease into, because people had linked croc diversity to global climate temperatures, at mean average temperatures. And I think that is true. But the temperatures aren't changing dramatically through these mass extinctions. Now, to kind of get back to your question, what are the implications for today? First of all, I can't be 100% sure, but they do well in warmer climates, and so which is why they're restricted to kind of the tropics more or less today. As those temperatures are going to warm up, you would expect them to move further north and south. Remember, because we're also going into the southern hemisphere too. And not only that, alligators, so speaking for North America, alligators do quite well in cold temperatures. And so, you know, it went viral a couple of years ago in North Carolina. There are these little tiny ponds that would freeze over and you'd see the alligator noses poking out because they basically just, they don't hibernate, but they kind of chill out. and they just poke their nose out so they can breathe every couple of minutes and then otherwise just hang out. And they're really good at that for like 2 weeks. So they are probably going to, you know, if we allowed them to expand, I bet we would see some northward expansion, especially in North America. Not only that, the historical accounts of early settlers, especially in areas like Tennessee, probably alligators are like native that far north. Even in Oklahoma, they're hanging out in southeast Oklahoma. So, yeah.
Well, they've survived 230 million years. Who's saying they can't survive through this event here? Well, in the intro, I was talking about, and I've read in your report, that your work can help other species survive this current mass extinction. How is this research going to be applied to hopefully helping the survival of other species?
What we have shown and are hopefully showing is that being a generalist, being a flexible eater is really beneficial during kind of these traumatic events of Earth's history. So being able to draw on insects, which typically do pretty well through mass extinctions, or smaller things because they can hide really well, allows you to survive. And so for other organisms, or for especially for conservation efforts, really focusing on animals that are specialists is critical, because they're the ones that are going to be at a bigger risk. You know, if you are really good at eating one thing, but then that thing goes extinct, then you're in deep trouble. The odds are you're going to go extinct. But if you eat 20 different things and 18 of them go extinct, well, you can still grab two of those, hopefully. And so that is a good thing. And so, you know, that would be my biggest takeaway. And this is, again, a pattern that we see probably in mammals during the end Cretaceous mass extinction as well. And so this isn't unique to crocs. It's a pattern that we continually see.
You've studied crocs for a long time. How have they changed? How have modern day crocs changed from those from 230 million years ago?
I love that question. It's such a fascinating story, because if you allow me to talk about human biases, we always think about like, oh, being warm-blooded, quote unquote, warm-blooded is better. But early crocs, like similar to early dinosaurs, were probably much more active than the ones today. And we don't know if they're warm versus cold-blooded, maybe somewhere in between, but they were terrestrial. They had long, thin limbs. They were very likely active. Many of them were active predators, although maybe they were, you know, taking small things too. And then through time, they secondarily evolved this role that you see today, the semi-aquatic ambush predator that just hangs out basking. So this has been a really successful strategy for them, moving away from things that we otherwise think are successful to think something that we think of as being outdated or like a relic of the past. That's actually relatively recent. And the other big change, and this was kind of a big shock to me, was all crocs today are semi-aquatic ambush predators. There is some diversity. The gharials are more of a fish specialist. Nile crocodiles, American alligators are better at taking big things, you know, a wildebeest or a deer, depending on where they're living. But in the past, we've had these terrestrial omnivores, these herbivores, these terrestrial hypercarnivores that are running around. And slowly but steadily, they have kind of disappeared until all that's left are the modern day semi-aquatic generalists. But that is basically unique to the last 20 million years. Even 25, 20 million years ago in South America, we had these really big, almost wolf-like hypercarnivores called cebecids. That were really pretty scary and pretty awesome. And it's one of my great regrets not living 20 million years ago to be able to see these things and trying to figure out, you know, trying to understand how they lived. It's pretty cool organisms.
Wait, are you saying that the cebecit had some relation to a crocodile? You said wolf-like.
because I want people to think of like a kind of more active predator. They didn't, they weren't like wolves. They weren't related to mammals. They are distantly related to modern day crocodilians. It was this branch called Notosuchia, probably, that they belonged to, which related to our study, Notosuchians were super, super diverse in the late Cretaceous and had all of these crazy skull shapes, tooth shapes, diet adaptations. So that's where most of our herbivores, our omnivores are hanging out. And cebecids are the only group of Notosuchians to make it through the end Cretaceous mass extinction. And they do really well, but probably couldn't make it with the cooling climates.
Yeah. It's interesting about crocodiles, modern crocodiles. I think you called them ambush predators. Yeah. How, we could never do this, lay around basking in the sun all day and then suddenly jump up and go, I don't know how many miles an hour they can run towards a predator, but it's very fast. Like you'll never get away from a crocodile. I mean, if we were to do that, you know, our Achilles tendon would just spring rupture. But that's kind of a crazy and interesting, I don't know if it's unique among other reptiles, mammals.
It's not. It's really, crocs are such a wonderful example of what we call convergent evolution. This independently coming together to solve the same problem. So you see, crocs aren't even the first croc-like thing. There are phytosaurs, which are now extinct, and that look very similar to modern day crocs, except their nose, their nostrils are in the middle of their forehead instead of on the tip of their snout. And then before that, there were croc-like amphibians that are now very long gone, but lots of other things have done it. But they've just been the most successful in the last 180, 200 million years.
Well, our guest today has been Keegan Malmstrom. He's the lead author on a fascinating new paper talking about how crocodilians have survived the last two mass extinctions by what they ate. We will provide a link to this paper on our website. Keegan, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a blast.
You've been listening to Cool Science Radio. And coming up in June, we have interesting interviews with the U of U Hydro Lab about the impacts of dust on snowpack and spring runoff. And then we also speak with UK reporter Willem Max about companies starting to explore the deep sea for minerals. All this and more on Cool Science Radio.